So this morning, in lieu of just coming off of our community retreat, we're going to talk a bit about community. So to get us started, just share with someone next to you what comes to mind when you think of community. All right, just share it with someone. Go. All right, let's hear some of these. What comes to mind? Community. Anybody?
Toleration of screaming babies.
Good. I like that. Uh huh. Anybody else? Food, uh-huh, someone there? Large group acting as a family, okay, good. I think, what was that? Comfort, good. Sharing, okay. So we started a letter 2 weeks ago. The lectionary text is in 1 Thessalonians, and we are unfolding this letter where Paul wrote, and he's explaining to this young startup community how to be a community. And so one of the last illustrations I used 2 weeks ago was this. I basically said, in American Christianity, sometimes communities are set up in a non-sustaining way. Like we're looking for that big emotional rush and that hit. And then I told this story. I have a friend of mine who's very even-keeled, not very expressive emotionally, very cerebral in his faith. He went to school on the East Coast, and when he was going to school, there was this period in the campus at his school where there's a lot of unity, like God was doing something with all the different groups. And so they came up with this idea where they would pray together and pray over the school and then the region. So they divided up this weekend. Everyone had a time slot. Each group had a representative, and they would come pray. So my friend was chosen as the representative of his group, and he's like, fine. So he shows up, and then he walks into this room that overlooked kind of the area. It was on the top of a hill. And he walked into this room, and he said the room was going crazy. Like, people were, like, screaming and crying. There's, like, people dancing with, like, ribbons. And then so he kind of, like, walked into this and then tried to hold a conversation with one of his friends. But there was, like, no conversation because the guy was, like, in a trance. And then they all surround him, and then they go, "Are you from this campus group?" And he was like, "Yes." And they go, "Well, we feel that God has called you to dance on the sins of all the generations that have gone before." And then they go, "So dance." And so my friend was like, see, just, and they're like going, and people are like yelling. He's like, "This is kind of weird." And then it just like kind of worked up into a frenzy. He felt like he was dancing for a long time. He said it was probably 5 minutes. And then he just kind of danced his way out of the circle and left. And he was like, no one even noticed I was gone. So I told that story 2 weeks ago, and this is what I said. I said that our faith often is set up in this way where we're looking for that rush and that hit, and it's not sustainable. And this is what I said 2 weeks ago. We learn this as kids. You grow up, and then you go to camp. You have these amazing times of community because you're kayaking and canoeing and ziplining and jumping on blobs with Jesus. And then so you associate your faith with that. Then you come back to your everyday life and you're like, wait, my life isn't like that. And then you go through the rest of your faith journey looking for that hit. We're like junkies, right? And so I thought this morning, since we've come off of our unusually incubated time together, right? We had some swimming that took place, which was wonderful. We have this beautiful community that we're a part of. Our time was extraordinary, right? It was out of the ordinary. And so the question I want to ask then, perhaps more importantly, how do we become a community day to day? What values do we have that form our community that I propose is more important than these incubated and formative times? They're helpful. But day to day, what does community look like then? And so this letter is Paul writing to this startup community. Thessalonica at the time was probably around 200,000. It was a cross-section of people because it was on the trade route. And a lot of people were moving in, much like our city, which is a medium-sized city, which John Stewart says, apparently this is the immigration problem right here in Austin. Everyone's coming here, right? And so the question he was asking to them was then, how then do we live day to day? How do we become a community that's sustainable for the long haul? So this morning we're going to unpack that a little bit. Dietrich Bonhoeffer says this. He says, a person who loves their dream of community, if we have these ideas and this ideal of community, if we love that dream, we'll destroy community. But the person who just loves those around them, so just look around. If we just love the people who are next to us, we'll create community. And so this morning, what are some values that might drive that? We're going to be in 1 Thessalonians 2. Go ahead and read verses 1 through 9, and then we'll walk through it. We've got it on the screens. 1 Thessalonians 2. Go. All right. So this morning, in the second chapter, Paul's explaining how he modeled community and leadership, and then so they can take these values and live day to day. So we'll unpack this a little bit. So he says in verse 1, "You know, brothers and sisters, that our visit to you was not without results, literally fruitless. It wasn't fruitless. Our time we came, there was fruit to be shown." That's what he's saying. "We'd previously suffered and been treated outrageously." So he was writing this. He had gone on his second road trip, and then they would go to these cities. He would tell God's story, and then communities would start forming. And then there would be this pattern as communities form. The religious establishment of the day, which was in bed with the political establishment, this was dangerous to their well-being. And so they would have people who were employed specifically to stamp out this movement. These people were previously Paul's colleagues. He probably knew a lot of these people. So he would go into cities, the communities would form, and then they would go and attack him. They would persecute him. They would throw him in jail to the point where they had different rules. If you're a Roman citizen and if you weren't, you could abuse those who weren't. And if you were, then you had some protection. And then along the way, they found out, oh, wait, this guy, we shouldn't be treating this guy like this. And then he's saying that we came to all these cities. And then in verse 2, "We had previously suffered, beaten, jailed, treated outrageously in Philippi, as you know. With the help of our God, we dared tell you his gospel in the face of strong opposition." So this is what he's saying. He's saying, we're going from city to city. We've come to your city. And then in our struggle, like for him, it was literal physical struggle. In our struggle, he says, there was fruit that came of it. And so maybe a question we can ask this morning is, what is our struggle? So what is that struggle that you're engaged and involved in for the last couple weeks? So just think through what you did the last 2 weeks. Think about what you invested time and energy, what you woke up for, what some of the hard stuff was. And then the question is, what fruit is going to come of it? In your struggle, is it bearing fruit? I was doing some sermon research this past week at the Violet Crown Cinema, and I saw this amazingly beautiful film called Birdman. Has anyone seen it? Oh, it's so good. So Michael Keaton plays this washed-up actor. He's kind of a movie star of a comic book franchise. And now he's kind of in the twilight of his career and trying to reinvent himself. So check out the clip.
How did we end up here? In this dump. You were a movie star, remember?
So this film, it's unbelievable. The whole thing is shot like it's one sequence that's uncut. So I think most of the cuts were about 15 minutes long. I heard Zach Galifianakis talk about how when he would just wait there. And if there's 15 minutes of film right before you, you don't want to be that last person who messes it up. So the sound guy would hear him go, all right, they're coming. Oh my God, they're coming. And then the film is unbelievable. It's commentary on art versus commercial success. On popularity, there's just it's beautiful, beautiful. So this is my take on the main character that Michael Keaton plays. So he's lived this life with a lot of commercial success, making what he seems like even in his own mind is subpar art, but very popular. So now he's done that for the last few decades, and he's enjoying the fruit of popularity. And this is just how popularity. This is what it tastes like. Sometimes you're hot. And oftentimes, you're not. And so now he's tasting that fruit. This is the work that he's been doing. And now in his middle age, he's like, this is my struggle, and I don't like this fruit. And now he's trying to reinvent himself. Can you do that at a middle age and start gardening and creating another fruit to eat? That's the question of the film from my perspective. But I think for us, it's worth asking that. As we struggle, as we work, as we put in time, play it out 20 years. What is that fruit going to taste like? I have two more things here before we move on. So in the scriptures, so I think a lot, oftentimes when we think of the work that we do, a lot we think of our vocation and our calling. And I think that's important. But in the scriptures, it seems like what's more important is the fruit of our character. It's God's more concerned with who we are than what we do. And so you take a guy like Joseph, who was an egomaniac, a sociopath. He would have these visions. He would stand up in his family and go, this is my vision. This is the vision for my life, that my family would worship me one day. That's my dream, right? That's crazy. So they hate him, and then they sell him off to slavery, and then the people who buy him as a slave sell him again. And then he goes through this narrative that's challenging and difficult, and the whole time, God's working on the fruit of his character. And he now works his way. He does good work as a slave, where he's now second in command to one of the most powerful men in the empire, only then to be falsely accused of rape and then thrown in prison and then forgotten. And then decades pass and pass and pass. And then his life comes to this one point. It culminates to this one point where he now has power. And he now is in a place where retribution and revenge on the brothers who sold him can happen. He has the power to do that. And in this one moment, they meet again. And the fruit is, instead of revenge and retribution, it's forgiveness. And so for us, where we live in a very pragmatic society, we think about what we do. Maybe the question is, what is the fruit of who we are? All right, second question. When we come to a community, so some of us have been at Vox for maybe a year, a couple years. Think of all the churches you've been a part of, okay? So just list, you know, every city you've moved to, you probably joined another church. When you enter into this community, what fruit are you trying to create within the community? Is the community more fruitful because you're a part of it? If you have to move to another city because of work, does that community lose something because your fruit is no longer part of that community? Does that make sense? So I'll give you an example. So this past week, we had a beautiful weekend of community. There was swimming, there was yoga, we ran together, ate together, through fruit, right? It was wonderful. We enjoyed that fruit. And it was because one person, Amy, said, hey, I'd like to volunteer and take my skills and my leadership. And she worked really, really hard. She struggled for a few months, put a team together, and we got to enjoy the fruit of her labor. And if each of us saw community in that way, and saw our part and our talent and our place, and just to ask, as we engage in a community, what fruit over the next 2, 3, 5, 10 years? And so Paul starts the second chapter, and he's like, I struggled, but this is the fruit. I'm hearing reports of this community. People are talking about your church. It's amazing. All right, let's keep going. So in verse 3, he says this. Then he said, for the appeal we make does not spring from error or impure motives. He said, we didn't have an impure agenda. That's what that word means. When we came, we really honestly wanted the best for you. This was his motive. We weren't trying to trick you. On the contrary, we speak of those approved by God and trusted with the gospel. We're not trying to please people. Our motive wasn't to please you or to please the community. It was to please God who tests our hearts. You know, we never used flattery, nor did we put a mask to cover up greed. We weren't trying to create organizations so that we could have a living and make more money. We weren't trying to use religion for money. That's what he's saying. God is our witness. We're not looking for praise from people, not from you, for anyone else. Even though as apostles of Christ, we could have asserted our authority. So he's saying, we came now, and our agenda was good. It was to please God. That was our motive in coming in. So maybe we can ask this. What is your agenda? I think maybe you're like me, and if someone asks me, I always go, oh, I have no agenda, right? We always say, I don't have any agendas, right? You move into a neighborhood and be a good neighbor. I don't have no agendas, right? But I propose that maybe that's not possible. Maybe you just have an agenda that's named or not named. And if we all have some sort of agenda, we should probably name it, because your agenda is either going to be a good agenda or a bad agenda. Okay, I'll give you an example. So with families, the holidays are coming up, okay? We're going to go be with our families, and oftentimes that's complicated, yes? Right? So in your next family gathering, do you have an agenda? You'll probably go, oh, no, I love my family. They're great, right? My mom, my dad, my weird uncle, but no agenda. Have you seen the movie August, Osage County? Oh, okay. So I had heard for many years it was good, and I wasn't that interested because I figured I didn't relate to rural Oklahoma and a matriarch and her three daughters. I was like, there's nothing in that story that I can relate to. But so many people had told me it was good. So I was speaking up a couple weeks ago, and then between sessions, I would just play it on my laptop. I didn't know what to expect. So I actually watched the film in like two or three parts, and then I would watch film alone in my room and then have to hit pause, and I would come out like, what the heck just happened? And it is so incredible and so, so hard to watch. It is so difficult. And in this movie, even though I personally can't really relate to a rural Oklahoman matriarch with three daughters, but the universal struggle of family and the ways we hurt each other and how that plays out over generations, that's universal. And when I was watching this, if we were to ask each of the characters, you're coming to this family gathering because of a tragedy, what is your agenda? They probably would have said, I have no agenda, I'm just coming to my family. But they did, right? When we go to our families, we want to be heard. We want to be loved. When people hurt us, we want them to say sorry. And that, we want, right, an apology. That's an agenda. So what if the next time you go be with your family, just say, you know what? Maybe I'll have an agenda. I should just name it. Maybe I'm going to go in. I'm going to be a good listener. That's my agenda this weekend. Maybe I'm going to find something kind, like a kind thing to say to someone. Maybe I'm going to forgive somebody in some way. Have an agenda. Okay, I'll give you another example. Let's take the food community in Austin. So when you go to a restaurant, do you have an agenda? Right? You probably wouldn't have named it. You'd be like, no, I'm just going to eat. And I would propose that our agenda going to restaurants in Austin is absurd. It's not even reasonable. Okay? So there's a new restaurant on Cesar Chavez in Springdale called Sawyer on Red Bluff. He's been there. So I went and tried it out, and it's beautiful. It's a gorgeous restaurant, and Mickey did it, and everything she touches is always wonderful. And then people ask about the food, and, you know, the food's okay. So I would say a reasonable agenda going to a restaurant. So we live in a world where most of the world may never go to a restaurant their entire life. And most people in the world maybe goes to a restaurant once. We live in a society where we go three or four times a week, maybe, right? And then I would say a reasonable agenda in exchange for your money. So we've worked hard for our money, and then we're exchanging that, right? I think a reasonable agenda would be if the food is clean and it doesn't make me sick. That's reasonable, right? There's a person working hard, slaving away in the kitchen, and then the food comes out. Not only does the restaurant need to be beautiful, then the food just doesn't have to be okay. It doesn't have to be good. It needs to be exceptional and better than the last restaurant. And that's just, I'm not, like, what? Who am I, the Prime Minister of Canada? Like, why do I expect that? Okay, so let's take this food metaphor. And now let's say we're invited to a potluck. What is your agenda? If you were to take that same agenda that you have for restaurants, the Yelp agenda, if we take that to a potluck, what if we saw each of our dishes as it not only needs to be, oh, it needs to be beautiful, and not only just be good, it's going to be like the best thing that I can make. Can you imagine if we all thought of a potluck that way? And imagine then going to this potluck, how amazing would that be? And so the question for us, when we enter into a church and into a community, what is our agenda? we should probably just name it, right? In this text, Paul's saying, my agenda is to please God. Okay, so we get that. So all of our agendas should be to please God. That's not that helpful. Because what does that even mean or look like? Right? We all think of different things. So in the scriptures, to love God and please God, God makes it tangible. What does Jesus say? How do you know if you're loving God well? Look at your neighbor, okay? Which is genius, because a neighbor is just pure geography. It's just space. No matter where you are, there's someone next to you at all times. So when you walk into a community, how to please God, just look at how you're loving your neighbor. Just look around. In this space, in this time, during liturgy, these are your neighbors. Okay. Let's try to make it even more practical. Then what if, how do we engage our neighbors then? What agenda should we have? I think I have a chart here. Can we go to the chart? So we have God, right? That's true, but not that helpful. Okay? Let's put some skin on it so it's our neighbors, right? How do we love our neighbors? Let's have an agenda for that. Then I propose in the scriptures that maybe our agenda should to be bear fruit. So when you come into a community, maybe my agenda is, how can I be a loving person? Oh man, that guy's really hard to love. Then that's good, because you're practicing how to love, right? Joyful. You meet this person who every time is a Debbie Downer, and you're like, oh, made eye contact with that person. Gonna pretend that didn't happen. But in that space then, maybe we sit and we listen, and then we think about how can I bring joy in this moment? Peace. Maybe there's people who are antagonistic and just really aggressive, and everything they say just has kind of like this edge to it. And we don't want to talk to them. You don't want to be in a community with people like that. But maybe if our agenda is to learn how to be a peaceful person, maybe that's a good thing. And then what if we then, as a community, week in, week out, and we gathered, and let's have motives to please God, to love our neighbor, and to bear fruit. Dietrich Bonhoeffer says this. He has a book about community, and he says a lot of people come with this agenda. He says the Christian community is not a spiritual sanatorium. The person who comes into a fellowship because he's running away from himself is misusing it for the sake of diversion. He's saying, when he was writing this book, there are people who use communities to self-medicate. That's what he's saying. They're using it to distract themselves. And he says that's not a good agenda. Right? And he says, because he's running away from himself, misusing it for the sake of diversion, no matter how spiritual this diversion may appear, he is really not seeking community at all, but only a distraction which will allow him to forget his loneliness for a brief time. The very alienation that creates the deadly isolation of man. And he speaks in this book about the different agendas that we have and what does it look like to become a community. All right, let's finish this up in verse 7. And then he says, so this was my posture. This was my agenda in leading and forming this community. He said, instead, we were like young children among you. We were like cute babies. Just as a nursing mother cares for her children with that gentleness and that tenderness, so we cared for you because we loved you so much. We were delighted to share with you not only the gospel of God, but our lives as well. So we didn't only want to tell God's story. We wanted to live it in a way that was tender and gentle, like a nursing mother. This is what God's love feels like, looks like. Surely you remember, brothers and sisters, our toil and hardship. We work night and day in order not to be a burden to anyone while we preach the gospel of God to you. You are witnesses, and so this is God, of how holy, righteous, and blameless we were among you who believed. For you know that we dealt with each of you as a father deals with his own children. He's like, I treated you like a good father, encouraging, comforting, urging you, like, you can do this, right? Keep going. Like, I'll urge you in a gentle way, and keep struggling. It's worth the struggle. Bear fruit to live lives worthy of God, who calls you into his kingdom and glory. And so he's saying his main agenda and posture coming was like a nursing mother. It was gentle. It was tender. So if we were to take a character trait, if you were to walk down the street and ask the average person, when you think of the American church, name a character trait. Okay, someone shouts them out. When people think of the American church, judgmental, Anybody? What do people think of? Exclusive? Consumers? Hypocritical? Stubborn? So lots of good things, right? And I reckon that no one would say gentle. No one would ever say that. And for us as a community, I think it's not that helpful just to criticize the church, because there's a lot of people doing that already. So I propose, what if we just offered another way? And what if one of our goals, what if our agenda in our city was, when people think of Vox in our community, like, what do you think of Vox? That little weird church in like 12th and Airport. They go, they're gentle. And we go, thank you, right? And I think gentleness, if you think about gentleness, gentleness comes from a place of strength. When you're threatened, right, when you feel insecure, you come with power. But when you see a baby, you're not threatened by a baby because it's a baby, right? Then you can be tender and gentle. Okay, so before you show these pictures. So you know when there's demonstrations and people are rioting, what do the police always come with? They come with riot gear and tear gas. In Hong Kong, when they were demonstrating, it was a very peaceful demonstration. They were very polite. And then they came with shields and with, like, tear gas, which just riles people up. It's like they're not accomplishing anything. My solution, I think they should bring babies. So imagine a demonstration, and then just disarm them. I've got, like, six pictures of, like, you throw this in the front line of a riot, right? People are coming with strength. They'll just, oh, it's a baby. You can keep going through. Just like, how can you, you're just like, oh, it melts you, right? Look at these babies. They're just cute. Because they're not threatening. And you are stronger and older, so you come from, you, like, look at that. That would solve, like, the world's riots right there. Someone sent me this, I guess there's a YouTube viral video of a child, a toddler, who falls into the gorilla thing at the zoo. So check out the clip.
He couldn't see the gorillas, and so I just held him up, and he was holding on the wall, looking over. And then when I turned around to pick up the other one to hold it, lift him up, he'd actually pulled himself up and actually stood over and obviously fell over.
As a bystander keeps filming, Levin's family and onlookers fear the worst. Then, a fully mature 400-pound male gorilla named Yambo approaches the unconscious boy. The creature's 17-inch biceps and massive chest could tear the child to pieces. The crowd holds their breath as the boy's life hangs on the edge. But what happens next stuns everyone. In one astounding gesture, Yambo's touch goes from terrifying to tender.
Excuse the musical choices of the commentary. I'm not sure why that's necessary. But what would that look like? And I just did a quick search of the theme of gentleness in Scripture, and it's alarming how repeated it is and how seldom we ever talk about it. And I'll just read some to you. The proverb says this: a gentle answer turns away wrath, but a harsh word stirs up anger. Paul says this. He says, by the humility and gentleness of Christ, I appeal to you. I, Paul, who am timid when I'm face to face, but bold towards you in a way. He's saying, when I write, there's like a confidence to it, but when they see him in person, he's gentle and timid. And he says, I do that because I'm trying to be like Jesus. He tells the community in Ephesians, be completely humble and gentle, be patient, bearing with one another in love. Tells the community in Philippi, let your gentleness be evident to all. Peter says this, but in your hearts revere Christ as Lord. If anyone asks you about the hope that you have, be prepared to give an answer, and then do this how? With gentleness and respect. And then Jesus says this, take my yoke upon you and learn from me. Right? If you're tired, you're weary, learn from me. Like, take my burden, because my burden is light, and I'm gentle and humble in heart, and you will find rest for your souls. And then Brandon Manning says it like this: Live in the wisdom of accepted tenderness. Tenderness awakes within the security of knowing that we are thoroughly and sincerely liked by someone. Scriptures suggest that the essence of the divine nature is compassion and that the heart of God is defined by tenderness. And so what would that look like for us? For us each to have an agenda as we engage and come into this community and then to work at it for years and then one day to look behind us and there's just fruit littered all over the place. And I'll just close with this story. So we first moved to East Austin 8 years ago. And when we first moved in, we made a nemesis in the neighborhood. And there was this nemesis trying to get rid of us. And we soon quickly figured it was this old, beautiful pecan tree in our front yard that was trying to destroy us. We knew that it was trying to get rid of us because my son, who was in second grade, what he had just deposited in the toilet started coming out of the shower minutes later. He was like, "Dad, what is this?" I was like, "Mate, get out, get out." And so the pecan tree was like, "Welcome to the neighborhood," and its roots just slowly kind of went in through the plumbing. And then later that same week, it started hurling sedan-sized branches at us. I was reading a book, and this branch fell on the house, and I thought the house was coming in. I was like, "What the?" It was like loud, and there's this huge branch. I was like, "Oh, trying to kill us, right?" So I called the tree doctor, and I said, "Help! The tree's trying to kill us. We're not going to make it. Come right away." And he's like, "Well, sir, the next appointment I have is next Wednesday. Will that work for you?" I was like, "No, that won't work. We're going to die." And then he goes, "Sir, calm down. Can you tell me if the tree is dead or alive?" And I said, "Oh, I know the answer to that question." Because that year, every other year, like this year, was pecan season. And so every 5 minutes, this tree was hurling pecans at our house. It was like every 5 minutes. Karen said I would respond to the tree at night. I'd hear, I'd be like, "Hello, come in." She's like, "They're pecans." So the question is, do these pecans give the tree life? No. But these pecans are a sign that the tree has life. And I pray that we as a community will struggle and do our work for the next 5, 10, 15, 20 years. And we'll look back and there will be the streets littered with the fruit of what God's doing in us and through us. Let me pray for us. And so, Vox, may we go now, remind one another to lead lives worthy of the calling we've received. May we walk together in gentleness and humility. And may our words and lives be one in Christ. May we go in peace and humility and gentleness together as a community, learning to love God and each other and the world around us. In the name of the Father, of the Son, and of the Holy Spirit.